Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at airtainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Lindsay Lohan and her co-stars talk to me about the new Christmas movie, Our Little Secret. The great Bill Nighy talks to me about the new Netflix movie Joy, about the world's first IVF baby, and why he's still happy to talk about Love Actually. And Niamh O'Reilly is here to review all the week's new movie releases, including Wicked and Housewife of the Year. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I hope you've survived the cold, the wet, the snow, all of those things that bedeviled parts of the country throughout the week and are still continuing to do so. Now, by the time we got to air last week, we hadn't learned of the sad passing of John Kenny. And I just want to quickly start the show by mentioning the legend that was John Kenny.
And she was giving out show, I showed a disgrace. Look at the state of you. You're after getting drunk, you're after knocking down the figurines, you're after falling into the fire, you're after burning yourself, burning the cap, but you're after exploding all over the living room. And you're after making a show of me, and you're after making a show of Mammy. Well, fick it, says I, Bridie. That's a dirty dig now, says I, to Bridie. Well, you know the way you'd be yourself, like, what I mean? You know the way you'd be now with two crates of Guinness and a half bottle of whiskey inside you, like. You'd hate to have Mammy dragged into anything. You know what I mean?
That was a clip of John Kenny from the telly. One of the Dumbelievables specials. I remember owning that on VHS in the 90s. And John Kenny was on this show about 2 years ago talking about his favourite movie. I met him a few times over the years through here, and he was just a lovely, lovely guy and a really genuine guy who was just really interested in making art and making TV and comedy and doing plays and being in movies. And he was just a joy both on screen and off screen in my dealings with him and in my viewings of him. He was a very funny man and a great actor as well. And I just want to mention him, RIP, the legend and the wonderful John Kenny. Now, something else I didn't get to mention last week, and indeed the week before, and I've been meaning to mention, is Paul O. Coleman has just won the Best Animated Short category in the recent Paris Independent Film Awards for a very inventive movie about four farming brothers listening to a match on the radio with great music and they're drinking poutine. It's on YouTube. It's called Port Bale. And it's only 4 minutes or thereabouts long. And it's glorious. Really inventive little, and it's fair enough to call it a little, short movie that, as I say, is from Paul O. Coleman and won the animated short category in the recent Paris Independent Film Awards. And I did want to mention that. So do check out Port Bale on YouTube. Now, this week in TV, I was watching this.
This war's meant to be in the name of the people. But how come it's only our people taking their lives in their hands every time they pop to the shop?
Got a bit of a scare today.
It's not about today.
Well, we're supposed to have lunch at the Hawaiian.
Walked up 2 minutes late, found it on fire.
I'd say you were right on time.
Girls, this happens to everybody. Oh, no, it's spooky.
I'm not spooked, Doc. I want to bomb London.
Oh, come on, kid.
Sure, the IRA planted 6 bombs today, 6, and we barely made the local news.
Luke, you're not wrong. What's the target?
The Old Bailey.
Now, that was a clip from Say Nothing, which is new on Disney Plus, which you may have heard about. Lola Pettigrew, who you heard there, plays Dolores Price, a Republican IRA member in the 1970s, along with her sister Marion, played by Hazel Doop. In this, we have them getting highly involved in the IRA campaign and becoming kind of leaders of the IRA campaign in the 70s. And we also have Maxine Peake playing Dolores Price in later life when Boston College came up with something called the Belfast Project, where people involved in the Troubles would talk about their experiences. There's a great cast in this. Tom Vaughan Lawler is in there as well, playing the head of the famed B Company during the IRA bombing campaign in the 70s and 80s. And it mixes timelines. It has the height of the Troubles in the 70s in Belfast, and then also the road to ceasefires and things like that. And you have Gerry Adams front and center in a lot of these episodes, and each episode ends with the line, Gerry Adams has always denied being a member of the IRA, but he is very much in this series, Say Nothing, seen to be the leader of the IRA. Now this, as I say, this has caused some controversy, some people claiming it's quite pro-IRA. I don't really see it that way. It may possibly give some reason as to why they wanted to join the IRA. They do carry out pretty horrific things that are shown in quite shocking detail. This, you know, history is a series of competing narratives, and people are going to have different takes on what happened in the North. If, and it's not really possible, but if you were able to view this in terms of a show that was entirely fictional and not based on real events, it is very gripping TV. It is superbly acted. Tom Vaughan Lawler is great. But in particular, Lola Pettigrew as Dolores Price is absolutely brilliant in it. The accents are spot on. They're all Irish actors, so there's no kind of paddywhackery telling like that. It's not a show without its controversies, but I think it's a gripping watch. I've had a couple of people mention it to me this week, and one person in particular who watched it in about two nights, and they're nine episodes and they're all about 40 minutes long. So Say Nothing is a very gripping piece of TV. It's certainly going to add to the conversation and the looking back at the Northern Ireland Troubles. So it's a thumbs up from me for Say Nothing, now streaming on Disney Plus. All nine episodes are there. Now, something very different is this.
Imagine this. I'm spending the holidays with my boyfriend's family for the first time.
Hi, Mom.
This is for you.
Look, it's a screw top. Fast and easy.
Here we go.
He has a lot of family members, too many to remember. And his sister is also bringing someone.
I want you to meet Logan.
My ex.
Will you?
No, Logan, I will not marry you.
It's so great to meet you.
Yeah.
You cannot tell anyone about us.
This is funny.
The last thing I need is to give that woman ammunition. Do we have an understanding?
You are a nightmare.
Gonna be fine.
So, Avery, where are you from?
Peachtree City.
No way, that's where Logan is from.
No way.
Such a small world.
Mm-hmm. You gotta work with me here.
I got this.
Are you guys ready for church?
No. Yes.
That was your fault.
That was a clip of Our Little Secret, which lands on Netflix on Wednesday the 27th. That's next Wednesday, 27th of November, I should say. So what we have is Lindsay Lohan. She finds herself trapped in exactly the type of holiday getaway she was hoping to avoid, a week with her ex-boyfriend, Logan, played by the Pretty Little Liars alumni, Ian Harding. She shows up at her new boyfriend's house, and it turns out her ex is there, and it's going to be horrible. And what doesn't help is the fact that they're only going out, but the mother of her new boyfriend is played by Kirsten Chenoweth, who people might know from Wicked. She's won Emmys and things like that. She's horrible as the mother-in-law-to-be, let's call her, and talks about, as you heard there, when she shows up, when Lindsay Lohan shows up with a bottle of wine going, oh, it's a screw tap. She's really the mother you don't want to meet. And of course, it's a rom-com. And this is Lindsay Lohan's kind of second Christmas movie. She did Falling for Christmas a couple of years ago. She did An Irish Wish last year. And she's somewhat, I suppose, reinventing herself a bit in this phase of her career as kind of a rom-com darling. And this is her third Netflix movie. So I got to talk to Lindsay Lohan about Our Little Secret. Also, her co-star Ian Harding and the aforementioned Kristen Chenoweth about Our Little Secret and a bit more besides. Hi, guys. John Fardy from News Talk Radio in Ireland. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. How are you?
Lindsay, this is the second time in 2 years I've seen you in a Christmas movie on Netflix. Falling for Christmas was the first one. Are you a big Christmas fan? Does it loom large in your life, or is it just a happy accident?
I mean, doing Christmas films is a happy accident, but I do love Christmas as well.
Everyone's a winner.
And also, I always, I mean, my career in general, I gravitate towards comedic, funny, happy, uplifting films. So why not throw the holidays into that as well?
Absolutely. It's a home run. Ian, you've been in other Christmas movies before as well. Is it weird to film, like, Christmas is a big thing in Ireland. It goes on for like a month, you know, and then we forget about it for 11 months of the year. Is it weird to film these movies in the summer or the spring or the autumn when the rest of the world isn't thinking about Christmas at all?
You know, what is sometimes fun, because I've done, I think, three Christmas projects now, and they usually come like after the holiday, and usually and like I did this one that was, we shot in Connecticut in like March, and so it was like very cold, very dreary, but we got to like bring that Christmas spirit back for just like, you know, as like the spring eventually came. So that was a little disorienting, but I mean, I really love them, because kind of no matter what time of year you shoot it in, it's always a joy. Unless you're shooting it in like July, and then you have to pretend like, oh, I'm so cold, and it's, you know, 90 degrees outside.
Hard.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're good actors, so you can manage that. Kristen, you've done lots of Christmas movies as well, but I won't ask you the same question because that'll just get boring. But what I was wondering was, she's really quite horrible to Lindsay, your character, the mother-in-law-to-be. The first line is, oh, it's a screw cap, when she offers her the wine. Are you, like, you seem like a very pleasant lady. Do you enjoy being horrible on screen? Because I've seen you do it once or twice before.
Well, that's why I'm pleasant. Because I can get out my horribleness in these roles, you see.
Yes.
I don't have to do it in real life.
It's like your therapy.
It is my therapy, actually.
Yeah, well, it's working for you. It's working for you.
Lindsay,
I sometimes bore people on this station that you're talking to me on by claiming to be Ireland's biggest Billy Joel fan. And I brought him up to Kevin Bacon a few months ago. And
there's nothing wrong with being the biggest Billy Joel fan. I'm from Long Island too. And so is he.
Well, I just wanted to ask you, if it's not too personal a question, you have one of his lyrics from I Go to Extremes tattooed. Do you? I'm not asking to see it. Don't worry. It's not about to get weird.
You're not going to. It's okay.
I know that. But in case you wondered where it was going, but you still have that. And I'm wondering why that song? Because it's one of my favorites, but you tell me.
I think when I got it, it was at a time in my life where like I was testing boundaries with myself. And now it's something I look back on. And it's actually where I am today. Like, clear as a crystal, sharp as a knife. I feel like I'm in the prime of my life.
So it was perfect.
And I think it's kind of a, like, almost not a metaphor, but it's something, as you know, sometimes we have to push ourselves to certain limits to understand ourselves in the long run, to become the person we want to be.
Amen.
Yeah, very wow. Well said. Does Billy know you have that?
I don't think so.
I'll tell him.
Maybe he'll find it. Now, I last saw you in an Irish
My week. Karaoke song, by the way, is We Didn't Start the Fire.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah.
It's a brilliant one. You know all the words, right?
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
that's
not an easy feat. Not an easy feat.
No, not. You need to write them out to learn them.
Any plans to come back to Ireland, Lindsay?
Yes, I would love. My husband and I really want to bring our son there. It's a very special place to me. I mean, it's the place where when I was with Aisha Curry there, we were talking about, I was saying how badly I wanted to have kids. And I made so many wishes there for that. And it happened very soon after. So it's a very, and my grandfather's Irish, so both of them. So it's a very special place to me. So I really want my son to come and see the beauty of Ireland, and everyone there is so kind. And yeah, it's a magical place.
That's beautiful.
Correct answer. We're out of time.
It's the truth.
Thanks a lot. And sorry, guys, we went down a Billy Joel rabbit hole. But
no, it's beautiful.
Thanks, guys. Cheers. Lindsay Lohan there, talking about her love of Ireland and what an important part she feels it played in her recent life. And also talking about Billy Joel. I had to bring it up. She's a Billy Joel tattoo. And you also heard me talking there to her co-stars, Ian Harding and Kristen Chenoweth. And they were talking to me about Our Little Secret, the new Christmas movie on Netflix, which is out next Wednesday, the 27th of November. Now, after the break, I'm going to be talking to the great Bill Nighy about his role in the new movie Joy, all about the world's first IVF baby. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time. Now, I want to talk about this.
Dr. Edwards,
Jean Purdy. I'm here about the lab manager's post.
Hey, Tam, don't be late. We have an obstetrician to catch.
Mr. Steptoe will be an excellent member of our team.
This team, which you've not yet explained to me.
Oh, we're going to help make babies. I've shocked you.
Making babies in test tubes?
You truly believe you can do that?
We're making the impossible possible. We are. You'll see.
You're aware we will unite the world against us.
Stop, Frankenstein!
What you're doing is disgusting.
It's wrong!
I'm helping people.
Mum, doesn't make it right. Is it in the interest of science?
Yes.
Infertility is a scientific problem.
It only affects a very small number of women.
Small number?
That is a clip from Joy, which is now on Netflix as of the 22nd of November. It did get a brief cinema release. Joy tells the remarkable true story behind the groundbreaking birth of Louise Joy Brown, the world's first, as was known at the time, test tube baby in 1978, and in particular, the tireless 10-year journey to make it possible. It's told through the perspectives of Jean Purdy, a young nurse, an embryologist who joined forces with scientist Robert Edwards and then surgeon Patrick Steptoe to unlock the puzzle of infertility by pioneering IVF. Joy celebrates the power of perseverance and, let's face it, the wonders of science. And we follow a decade of vertiginous ups and downs. The trio of mavericks and visionaries as they try battle against tremendous odds and oppositions from the real world to realize their dream. And in essence, allow millions to have families. And what I hadn't realized about the story of, you know, the birth, if that's not a pun, of IVF, is the huge, horrible opposition to it and the accusations this trio faced of being like Frankensteins and Nazis. It was awful stuff. So the cast of this is James Norton playing the scientist, Thomasine McKenzie playing the young nurse, and the great Bill Nighy playing Patrick Steptoe, the surgeon who was involved. It's a glorious movie. It's really delightful and uplifting, I have to say, and sad at times as well. A joyous film, as the name would imply. Now, I got to talk to the great Bill Nighy. Does Bill Nighy, an introduction? Love Actually, About Time, Living, star of stage, screen, TV, BAFTAs, all that kind of thing. He's a legend. He really is. And I got to talk to him about Joy, the unusual set it was, and a bit about his career as well.
Hey, John.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I'm a great admirer of your work, so it's a pleasure. It's the highlight of my week to talk to you. And I won't name drop the other people I'm talking to, but you're the highlight, you'll be pleased to hear.
Thank you very much.
Tell me this. I enjoyed the movie a lot. And, you know, I was reading a bit about it, and I gathered that there were people on set and various involvement in it who had firsthand experience of IVF and took it very seriously because of their own history. And I wondered, did it make it a very emotionally charged set, or was it a set like any other?
No, you're right. There was an element of that. It did definitely inform the general atmosphere. The producer, the director, and the writers all have IVF families. So it was therefore, you know, it was personal. And you did feel you already have a responsibility, obviously, to tell the story as best you can. But that was that did add to one's feeling of one's responsibilities. And it gave it some kind of context, you know, like a personal context.
Sure. You know, I'm talking to you from a country, Ireland, where we've had a long history of controversy about reproductive rights and things like that. And I grew up in a time when that was front and center and lived through it. But I'm completely unaware of issues about IVF. I'd never thought it had never occurred to me. But, you know, there's horrific stuff where people are getting dead dolls in the post. Were you aware of that? You're a little older than me. And do you see this maybe as a way of educating people like me and others about how hard those people had to fight for something which is so celebrated?
I absolutely do. I absolutely do see that as it actually shocked me, because I don't think at the time I was aware of the depth of the kind of violence of the opposition. I knew that the newspapers attacked them and the church came out against them and their families, but I didn't realize quite how powerful the opposition was. I do think it's important. It's like I made a film a while back called Pride, which was about gay young men and women who went to help the miners during the miners' strike. And that, I just think it's important that young people can see that was only 30 years ago. I always get that wrong. It's 40 years ago. And it's important that I think...
Time speeds up.
Yeah, quite. I always miss out the 70s. I think that's what I do. But it's important that young people know that there were those ridiculous attitudes towards gay people only 30 years ago. And similarly with this, whatever this is, 50 years ago, there was all this, that, you know, people panicked, but they could be forgiven for being panicked because the papers, in their normal way, in order to make money, invented the process as the work of the devil, Dr. Frankenstein. The children would be deformed, they would be mutations, they would be born monstrous. That was the devil's work, all of that. So that was how it was introduced to the public. And then when Louise Brown was born and she was a healthy, normal child, everybody had to shut up.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's funny how taken for granted it is now. The science is very digestible in it. Not that you're giving a biology lesson, but like, was it easy for you to, I know it's acting and that's your job, but like, could you get your head around that kind of stuff easily enough? Because it seemed to be written quite well and lucidly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's one of the great things. Because now it's, you know, it gives everybody a chance to see exactly what we're talking about, exactly what they're talking about, you know, and to see the events and the science as it happens. I could get my head around it. It took a little while. And I think the film, as you say, the film does it very well. It doesn't punish you with the science. It's fascinating. And it's very clear the process and what happened and what they discovered.
One of the effects it had on me was I'm a father of three, but there are terrifying moments in any pregnancy, which I'd never thought about until my wife was pregnant. And your film kind of brought that back. And I'm wondering, I don't know, I don't want to be too Dr. Freud, but I don't know. I know you have a grandchild now, for instance. Did you feel like after the movie going home and hugging her or reflecting on your own parental and grandparental journey?
Yeah, to some degree, you feel fortunate that you have healthy children. I have a healthy daughter and I have two lovely granddaughters.
Oh, two. My apologies.
Yeah. And also, I have many friends who have been through the IVF process, either successfully or in some cases not successfully. And I know the weight of that. You know, I know the burden of that and how grueling it can be and how desperately disappointing it can be. So I, you know, and it's that thing, you know, I didn't know very much about IVF, the process, before I made this film. And then, you know, then you discover that, you know, a large percentage of the people you know have IVF, you know, and people know you're making the film, so they come up and talk to you about it. So suddenly that you're aware of all these people that have benefited from or not from the process.
Yeah. Tell me this, staying with biology of sorts and physiology, you're 75 now, same age as Bruce Springsteen, is my understanding. You were in great nick, if you don't mind me saying, as we say in this part of the world. Have you lived a good life? I said, here's a name drop for you. I said the same thing to Eddie Murphy, and he said the reason was lack of stress. He became famous when he was 20 and never had to worry about money for the last 42 plus years. I'm wondering, do you have any similar thoughts on that? I presume you had more stressed life than Eddie Murphy, possibly.
Well, I don't have the same experience as Eddie Murphy, no. But I'm quite good at... I'm quite good at manufacturing stress where there isn't any. So I don't need to be, you know, I don't need to be broke to get this, you know, stress. So I don't know, really. I think it's just, I think I just got lucky. I think it's, you know, the fact that I'm in one piece, you know, and I have my sister and my brother are also slightly older than me, and they're, you know, we're in pretty good nick. I think that's just the luck of the draw, really. I mean, I do, yeah. I don't smoke.
Genetics,
you know, and I don't, and I work out, you know. I try and keep upright, and I keep supple. Other than that, and I, you know, I don't do anything. I don't ingest any toxins, really. But apart from that, I have
good. A normal existence, supple and subtle. That's going to be the byline for this interview. We come to the awkward moment in every interview you do in the last 15 years where I bring up Love Actually, but I'm going to be really quick on it. What I wanted to ask you was, I love that character, as I know you're probably tired of people telling you that, but it's just in that movie. Okay. But one of the things I liked, what I heard you talk about it before, was that you said the great thing about it was I didn't have to audition anymore. Now, this interview, post Love Actually, I presume that's still the case. I mean, you don't refer to auditioning 5 years after that or anything.
No. I did once. No, I mean, that was one of the great, ask any actor and they'll tell you that one of the things they dream of is never having to audition ever again. And I did once audition for a director that I particularly wanted to work with, and I failed the audition, by the way. Other than that, in the 20 years it is since that film, I've never had to audition, which is something I never thought I'd say. And it's one of the great facts about my professional and indeed my life generally.
Yeah. And then finally, I'm wondering, in this show that I present, a movie comes up quite a lot about time. And I'm wondering, because when that came out, you know, the critics were mixed, let's say the reviews were mixed, you know, but it seems to me it's taken on a life. It speaks to people about fathers and sons and all sorts of things. Have you had that experience that people like me and maybe people on the street bring it up to you a lot?
The film that I don't own a car. I walk everywhere and I meet a lot of people, therefore, and every single one of them wants to talk about, and they can never remember the title. You know, the one where you go in a cupboard and you make fists, they say. And I know what they're going to say before they even say it. They go, you know that? I go, about time. They go, yeah, about time. Yeah, it's entered the language. It was unevenly received when it was, but that's just, that's because there was a certain kind of critic who would respond to films. There are, you know, it's like Richard Curtis says, you know, there are films that are described as searingly honest are always the films that demonstrate how brutal and terrible and despair-filled life can be. Why can't films that talk about decency and compassion and joy and love and sex and romance, why can't they be considered searingly honest? There's a certain kind of squeamishness, particularly in England. There's a certain kind of squeamishness about portraying people in a fond and dear light, you know. It obviously hit the spot in a big way, and it's the film that everyone, over Love Actually now, people, I talk about time every day. It was also a huge hit in South Korea, and no one could work out why it was such a massive event in South Korea until a South Korean person explained that it very closely followed their Buddhist guidelines. And that in terms of relish the day and, you know, and also that the father-son relationship, which is crucial in any culture, I suppose, but is particularly emphasized in South Korea. But I'm very pleased. Yeah. And I had a man the other day, and people who expect not to like it. I had a man the other day who said, if I can sort of nearly swear, he came up to me in the street. He said, I saw one of your films the other day. I thought it was going to be shit. But it actually turned out all right. I can't remember what it was called. I said, About Time. He said, yeah, that's right. It was About Time it was called.
Listen, I'm out of time, ironically enough. Joy is far from shit as well, be pleased to hear. And it's lovely to talk to you. Continued success, Bill.
Thank you very much.
The great Bill Nighy there, talking to me about all sorts of things in his long and winding career, ostensibly though about Joy on Netflix, which is on Netflix from this Friday, the 22nd of November. A great watch, all about the pioneering people behind IVF and the struggle, the serious struggle they had to engage in to get it across the line and to get it to work. So it's a really great watch, I have to say. That's Joy on Netflix. Up next, the week's new movie releases, including Wicked. Now you're welcome back to the final part of Screen Time. We turn to the week's new cinema releases. Delighted to be joined by freelance writer and film buff, Niamh O'Reilly, who this week is looking at Wicked, the much talked about adaptation of the stage musical, comes to the big screen, and a fascinating looking documentary called Housewife of the Year. Yes, if you're a child of a certain age, you may remember that rather strange competition. Niamh, how are you?
I'm really good. How are you?
Would you ever dare to refer to anyone as a housewife these days?
No, probably not. It almost feels like a dirty word.
Yeah, it does.
But we'll get into that.
We will. But yeah, we better talk about Wicked, right? So I'm slightly in the dark about this, in that all I know is Wicked was a very successful stage musical, which was based on what happens to the witch after The Wizard of Oz.
You're on the right track. Yeah, okay. So I suppose...
Am I on the yellow road?
You're on the yellow brick road. You could call it maybe a prequel and a sequel in some senses, okay, to the original Wizard of Oz. So you're right, it was a very successful stage musical, started out on Broadway 20 years ago, it's toured all around the world. It's taken a very long time to get to the big screen. There's been a few issues here and there. Yeah. There was some controversy over the casting of Ariana Grande, who plays Glinda in this. But it's here and it's very good. It's well worth your time.
So I've read some reviews of this, having not seen it, and some people are really hating on it, but you're not.
I'm not hating on it. So I think probably most people are familiar with what the story is about, even if you haven't seen the musical. Now, I have to confess, I haven't seen the musical. I missed this when it came here, and I haven't seen it anywhere else. But I still am familiar with the story. It's one of those big stories that has kind of seeped into pop culture. Mm-hmm. So you probably are familiar with one of the big numbers, Defying Gravity, or Popular. And you know that Elphaba is green in it. So the basic setup is that it tells, I suppose, the story behind the story of The Wizard of Oz and how the witches of Oz came to be the witches of Oz. Mm. Most particularly the Wicked Witch of the West, whose actual name is Elphaba, and the Good Witch of the North, Glinda. Mm. So the film opens and we see that Elphaba has been born green, which is particularly strange. Nobody else is green. She's kind of shunned by her family. Her dad wants nothing to do with her, but she has some very strange abilities. She's able to move things by themselves. So she has powers. So very much to her life, she's kind of othered. Mm-hmm. She's on the outside.
Yeah.
I suppose probably becomes a little bit resentful or distrustful of people. So we flash forward and we see them. We see Elphaba in Shiz University, which sort of has Harry Potter vibes to it. It's like a wizard sort of university. And she is joined there by Glinda. And she is a very well-to-do, pink-loving young girl who just only cares about being popular and that people like her and that she gets her own way. So she's quite superficial, let's just say. So the two girls meet at Shiz University. They don't hit it off, but by circumstance, they have to share a room together. And so they kind of go from enemies to friends. And they have kind of quite a complicated relationship because they sort of, they're kind of the opposites of one another, but they bring out something within each other. I think probably Glinda brings out a little bit of sort of bravery in Elphaba and gets her out of her shell and that sort of thing. And then Elphaba kind of, I think, brings out Glinda's heart a little bit more. I think Glinda wants to be something more than she is. And Elphaba is someone who is very strong on her convictions and really believes what she believes in and doesn't care what anybody thinks of her.
Okay.
And she also has a sister called Nessa Rose, who is in a wheelchair. And that's why she's at Shiz University. She wants to keep an eye on her sister and make sure nobody messed with her and that sort of thing. So that's kind of the basic setup. There is a Prince Fiero who comes into the picture, played wonderfully by Jonathan Bailey, who you might remember from Bridgerton, the eldest Bridgerton son.
I think I've interviewed him, actually.
Yeah, you probably have. He's great. And he's very, playing this very camp and very almost Bridgertonly in it. So okay, really good casting. He comes in and complicates the relationship between Elphaba and Glinda because it's a bit of a love triangle going on there. And then eventually the Wizard of Oz gets wind of Elphaba's powers because she has these amazing powers. She can move things by themselves. So she gets a letter to come to the Emerald City to meet the wizard. And that's where part one ends, okay, more or less. And it stays very true to the musical in that sense.
And is this being billed as Wicked Part 1?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
So it's been very much split into two. Mm. And this is where the stage show would take its intermission.
Yes.
So it has stuck quite faithfully.
If you were in a theatre now.
Yeah, go and get your popcorn, yeah, go to the bathroom, that sort of thing. And I have to say the film is very long. It is bordering on 3 hours. It's 2 hours, 50 minutes. And that's long.
Are there big musical numbers?
So, yes. I mean, there absolutely is. Fantastic musical numbers. And I know maybe you're not the biggest fan.
No, but that's fine. Musicals. We're here to serve the public.
Absolutely. But I think you're probably representative of a lot of, mm-hmm, people may not be fans of musicals. But this is so richly done. And the numbers are fantastic. And what really makes this stand out is the vocal talent on display here. Sometimes when stage musicals are turned into film adaptations, the singers aren't, yeah, best. Perhaps they're better actors than they are singers. But here you've got people who can really sing. Cynthia Erivo is an O off getting her EGOT.
Okay.
So she's got her Emmy, her Grammy, and her Tony.
Oscar.
She hasn't got her Oscar. It's a very, very exclusive cohort of, yes, showbiz who have these particular, yeah, awards. She is a fantastic singer, and her numbers in particular are wonderful. But she also has the acting chops. Mm. So she brings all of this, you know, complicated stuff and baggage that Elphaba has with her, and she's fantastic. And Ariana Grande, I have to say, does a terrific job here. Her role, obviously, is slightly different. She's channeling like Alicia Silverstone and Reese Witherspoon, those sort of seemingly superficial characters that actually have maybe a little more yearning to be more, okay, than they are. And sort of the pink and leaning into it and swishing her hair. And so she actually comes across as a very good comedic actress, almost Goldie Hawn-like qualities to, mm, her. So I was quite impressed,
okay,
with her. And she's a wonderful singer as well.
She is. So why are some people hating on this, do you think?
I think probably some people don't like musicals,
yeah,
to start with. And I think the runtime is my biggest bugbear with this. The film, the first act, trots along quite well. It actually opens towards the end of The Wizard of Oz. So we see the pool of water, okay, that the Wicked Witch of the West melted into.
Yeah.
And we sort of see in the distance Dorothy and her chums heading towards the Emerald City. And we see Galinda going to Munchkinland. And, you know, they're celebrating the Wicked, yeah, Witch is dead.
Yes.
And she then recounts the story of how she met Elphaba. So it's a long runtime. The start is quite good and quite intriguing. Where it flags is in the middle. I think they spent far too long at this Shiz universe.
Okay.
Loses its propulsion a little bit. You get a little bit bored and you're sort of wondering, where is this going? And it almost feels like it's in a bit of a cul-de-sac at that point. When the third act, they make it to Emerald City, it really catches up again, and the story trots up a notch and it ends on a really high note and you're excited to see what happens next.
Okay.
But that dip, just for me, it took my interest sort of out of the story,
yeah,
and it just was too long. They could easily have shaved 20 minutes,
yeah,
off the runtime.
It sounds like it. And you know, I mean, The Wizard of Oz itself has lots of metaphors in it. I was particularly struck when you're talking about the lady who's born green. I presume there's plenty of metaphors here about
there's
difference
so
and embracing diversity.
This is a really, really layered story, and you can find so many, yeah, themes within this, but definitely one of them is, you know, accepting people, you know, who are different.
Yeah.
And, you know, not just in the fact that she's green, but her different abilities,
yeah,
really make her stand out, and trying to cross that divide and, you know, accept people for who they are.
So what would you say stars-wise for Wicked?
I'm going to say 4. It,
wow,
was really,
okay,
really entertaining.
Wow.
I mean, and the marketing machine behind this is huge. This,
yes,
feels like Barbie-level,
okay,
marketing, and this could go gangbusters at the box office. I think the fans of Wicked will love it. Mm. I mean, they're very strong fans, I think,
yeah,
you'd have to say, out there of Wicked. They really probably will defend Wicked to the hilt. But there are people out there, I think, that don't like musicals. This isn't going to be their bag. And yeah, look,
4 stars.
Yeah.
4 stars for Wicked, which is in cinemas from this Friday, which is the 22nd of November. And Eva Riley gives it 4 stars. Let's take a quick clip.
Why is it you're always causing some sort of commotion?
I don't cause commotions, I am one. Some of us are just different. Listen to me. You can do anything. I know.
threat to me.
That was a clip of Wicked, which is in cinemas now, and Niamh O'Reilly gives it 4 stars. Now, something very different is a documentary, which I'm dying to see. I haven't got to, because I do remember it on the fringes of my childhood, and even then thinking it was kind of odd, as the late, great Derek Davis talked about his potatoes wanting to be a bit harder than he was eating. The Housewife of the Year. What's going on, Niamh?
This is a fantastic documentary. It's by Kieran Cassidy. It's already won awards on the circuit. And it is telling the story of this really bizarre competition that ran in Ireland between 1969 and 1995. And
it started up to 1995.
Yeah. And wow, it started being televised in 1982.
Caller Gas were one of the sponsors.
That's right. They were one of the sponsors. People probably knew it as a Caller.
Yeah. At one point. Yeah. There.
Really strange. And it has been parodied much since. Mm. So it was hosted by Gay Byrne when it was televised. And this was huge. This was bigger probably than the Rose of Tralee, you know. Yeah. It was absolutely massive. Everybody watched it. And it sort of gave each woman a few minutes of fame on the stage. And this documentary looks back and it talks to some of the women who competed in this strange competition, some people who won it. And it's looking back at their, I suppose, reflections on it, and it's interspliced with real footage from the competition.
And the question I have is, because from this distance, you and I looking at it now, it seems absurd that you're going to, you know, be judged on what kind of housewife you are. But does this documentary try and explain that? I presume it's not entirely taking the Michael out of it.
No, what I really liked about this is that it walks a very fine line, because it's very easy for you and I to sit here and snigger out of it and say, what were you thinking? It's so ridiculous. You know, you're being judged on your ability to make a roast dinner and raise children. So it's very, very easy to dismiss that and laugh at it. But the filmmaker doesn't do that here, because for some women, This was a huge deal, and they still sit down and talk about it very fondly. Mm. And the woman who won the last competition still views herself as the reigning champion. She still has her tiara.
Okay.
And it was a huge moment for her. And for some of these women, it was life-changing. Mm. But the film also, I mean, it is an absolute snapshot in time, and it just shows you how stifled women were in the time when this competition was on, how powerless they were, how they were viewed in society, the lack of contraception, domestic abuse, religious control, no agency.
And are those things touched on in it?
Yes, they are. Okay. And they chat to some of the contestants. So one contestant, for example, she went on and won the competition in 1969. Her name was Anne McStay. She was from Ballyfermot. She was married at 20, a mother of 13 children, including 4 sets of twins. And by the time she was 31, and she said that the more children she had, the more her husband retreated into the pub. So she was very much on her own. She had to go to the food bank. She recalls coming home on the bus with like big pots of stew, being very embarrassed by that. Yeah. And she entered the competition because it was a small cash prize and you got a cooker. So she entered and she won. And then she said that it empowered her after she won. And later on, there's footage of her on the Late Late Show talking about contraception and how she needed access to contraception. This woman had 13 children, 4 sets of twins. And there's footage of, you know, a priest on with her on the couch talking down to her. And it's very shocking to look back at that. There's another contestant who was thrown into a Magdalen laundry as a young girl because her father had given her a camera. She went out on a rowboat with some friends, took some pictures, just larking about, having fun. The pharmacist developed it, jumped to conclusions, brought it to the local priest. The priest went to the parents and this woman was put in a Magdalen laundry. It touches on all of these things. And there's another woman who was terrified that her secret of being an unmarried mother would come out when she was a contestant. She had a child out of wedlock at 16, later on got married, had other children. But these were the fears and the stifling sort of conditions women lived under during this time. So it's a huge balance, balancing act the filmmaker walks here. You know, he doesn't make fun of it, and he sort of, you know, doesn't make fun of the women who see it as a big thing in their lives and still talk fondly of it, but he still examines the culture.
Very rounded, yeah.
At the time, it's really good.
And just to be clear, they were judged on things like the food they made, but the house they kept as well.
Yeah, so like when you got to the big final on the TV, like Gay Byrne would bring you out, and God bless Gay Byrne, I don't want to speak ill of the man, but like, he did kind of patronize them, mm-hmm. and infantilize them at times, you know, yeah. held their hand, got them to do a twirl, and, you know, how did you meet your husband? It was all very focused around your husband. How did you meet him? How many children do you have? What sort of dinner can you make? Are you civic minded? Mm-hmm. And then they would have to go off and make a dinner. And Derek Davis, as you mentioned, judges would come round and test it and say, that's nice, but I like my potatoes done a certain way. So it's a really fascinating look at how far we have come, I think.
It sounds really fascinating. So it almost seems strange to ask, but what would you give Housewife of the Year stars?
Five stars. Really good.
Very important documentary by the sounds of things. That's 5 stars from Niamh O'Reilly for Housewife of the Year, a great new documentary that's in cinemas also from this Friday. You should check it out. And if you're of a musical persuasion, you should probably check out Wicked as well, because Niamh gave it 4 stars. Niamh, thanks a million.
Thanks, Mill.
That's it for this week. There is no show next week due to the small matter of the general election. However, I will be back the following week with the great Richard Curtis and also Fiona Shaw. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. In the meantime, enjoy the remainder of your weekend, have a safe week ahead, and I'll talk to you all in 2 weeks.